Bookstack with Richard Aldous, the Books and Ideas podcast brought to you by AmericanPurpose.com. Coming up on the show today, my Bard colleague Ian Baruma, author of the new book Spinoza, Freedom's Messiah. Ian, welcome to Bookstack.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Congratulations on the new book. So remind us, who was Spinoza?
Well, Spinoza was a 17th century philosopher, and there, of course, it was an age of, on the one hand, extraordinary religious bigotry still, on the other hand, of great thinkers who laid the basis of the Enlightenment, which was to come about 100 years later. And of those thinkers, so there's Leibniz and Hobbes and others, Spinoza is probably still the most present, oddly enough, even though he was denounced for centuries after his death as the devil's disciple for his views on religion, which were considered to be very sacrilegious.
And one of the things actually that you show in the book is that one of the strange things about Spinoza is that his life and his ideas seem to attract all sorts, from radicals on the left to even leading Nazis in the Netherlands during the Second World War. Why is that?
Perhaps not leading Nazis. I mean, it was one person. But, well, I think partly because unlike some other philosophers or thinkers, and the word philosophy in the 17th century, of course, was more or less synonymous with science, but other thinkers, his thoughts were not entirely abstract, even though they're often regarded as such, especially the ethics, which has a mathematical, a geometric approach to philosophy. But his interest in philosophy was not just abstract or intellectual or to find out the truth in a scientific manner. It was really to provide people with a better way of living. And that's always attractive to people. And because some of his ideas are not easy to penetrate, you can interpret them in different ways. And so indeed, he's been taken up by people who otherwise would have very little in common.
And for somebody whose life and work was, to some degree, a quest for happiness, he does seem to rub a lot of people up the wrong way as well. This is a book in the Yale Jewish Lives series, but Spinoza was cast out and cursed by his own synagogue in Amsterdam, and even remains a banned figure to this day.
That's right. No, and not only cast out and cursed, but in harsh terms that really no one else experienced. I mean, the casting somebody out from the synagogue, the cherem, is something that happened a great deal, and often for minor infringements, and people were allowed back in very quickly. In Spinoza's case, it was very, very harsh, and he was indeed cursed and not allowed to ever consort with other Jews again, including his own family. Well, the main reason was that at quite an early age, he was cast out when he was only 23. He openly began to say things that went completely against not only the religious doctrine of the Jews, but perhaps even more importantly, the religious doctrine of the Protestants, who were still dominant in the Dutch Republic. And the Jews, even though they were in a more comfortable position in the Netherlands than they were in other European countries, they were allowed to practice their religion and so on. They were not allowed to become members of the guilds, but then nor were Catholics, or indeed Mennonites, who were perhaps amongst Spinoza's closest friends. I mean, they were the Protestant freethinkers. The Jews had to be very careful. They were there slightly on sufferance. And if they allowed a member of the congregation to say things about religion that would deeply offend the Protestants, their own position would be in danger. And I think that's one of the reasons that they were so harsh. And the things that really upset the Protestants, perhaps even more than the Jews, were slightly less dogmatic about these things, is that he said there was no such thing as God the Creator, as some figure or force that stands outside the world and creates it. So he thought God and nature were synonymous. God was in nature. He also did not believe in the immortality of the soul, which was perhaps a more important idea for Protestants than it was for Jews. He did not believe in miracles, and he did not believe in angels, and so on. And for a long time, those ideas were dangerous and too dangerous in his own lifetime for him to be able to publish any of his books except one under his own name. And the one was about the philosophy of Descartes.
Yeah, he was controversial in his own day for spreading heresies and for his views on the existence of God. I couldn't help reflecting as I was reading that these days that those views would probably get you a university chair or at least an appointment perhaps as the Bishop of Durham.
Yes, possibly, except the intolerance these days, of course, goes both ways. And there is the intolerance of the religious right, which is formidable, but inside the academy, the intolerance against people who go against a particular ideology to do with identity and so on is equally fierce. And I don't think Spinoza would have fared very well in that atmosphere either.
Yeah, I mean, you say at one point, my curiosity was piqued first because intellectual freedoms have once again become an important issue, even in countries such as the United States that pride themselves on being uniquely free. So this is a book about Spinoza, but clearly to you, this is also something that speaks to the current situation in which we find ourselves.
Absolutely. And it's one of the reasons I immediately accepted the commission, because first of all, I was curious because like anybody who grew up in, certainly my generation, who grew up in the Netherlands, you're very much bombarded almost with patriotic education. I mean, history education for my generation, maybe for yours, it had already changed, but was still very much an exercise in patriotism.
Yeah, and you speak at one stage about the Dutch Golden Age weighing heavily on you as a child in terms of education.
Well, yeah, not weighing heavily in the sense that I suffered from it, but it was very much part of our education. And the Golden Age was, of course, the age of Rembrandt and Vermeer and so on, but it was also the 80 Years' War against Spain. That's central. And the idea that, you know, your ancestors fought bravely for freedom against the Popish Spanish, that was central to our education. And so I knew quite a bit about the 17th century, but superficially, and I was interested in finding out more, and I was not an expert on Spinoza at all. So it was a wonderful learning experience. But the main reason, as you say, was that we are living in a time of intellectual intolerance, where to go against orthodoxies, whether they're secular or religious or conservative, well, conservative is one of these terms that has been bandied about when it really has no meaning at all. But let's say on the left and the right, or people who consider themselves to be progressive against those who consider themselves to be conservative, the notion that people who speak out against a dogma need to be cast out is very much part of our time. And the enemies of Spinoza were not quite the same as the enemies that we face today, but the situation is not so very dissimilar.
Yeah, and as you say, that revisiting the life of a free thinker in the contentious 17th century might help us come to grips with our own censorious time of dangerous political polarization.
That's right. And one thing, for example, one parallel is that the religious conflicts of the 17th century were very much part of elite politics and had a big influence on the academy, on the way that people are appointed as professor and so on, and the way things are taught. And one of the main conflicts in universities was between those who felt that the quest for truth should be religious and that the truth was God's word as revealed in the Bible, and that they should monopolize the university, people who believed that. And then you had the philosophers, as I said, who it's almost synonymous with the scientists, but who believes that there was a different way to find the truth, which was the more scientific way. And as is true today, these ideological conflicts were, of course, also about authority and about jobs and about influence and so on. And Spinoza's response was to say the religious idea of truth should have a place, as should the scientific way of finding the truth, but they should not be confused. So let the religious have their realm and you know, the stories of the Bible, if they make people behave better and so on, that's a fine thing. But don't confuse it with the reasoned approach to truth. And so you should separate the two. And I think that's a lesson that could possibly be applied in our own time as well, when it comes to contentious things like race and gender and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the fascinating dialogues which kind of goes on throughout the book that, you know, on the one hand, you do talk about the idea of objective truth, and yet you do allow time in the book to rehearse the arguments of those on the other side that would say that, you know, this is just another way of expressing privilege on all of these issues, the kinds of issues that you were just pointing out there.
That's absolutely right. And Spinoza argued that if we don't know something about something, if something seems still a mystery, it's simply because we don't know enough. It's not because there are mysterious forces that work like magic and so on. So he thought all that was superstition and nonsense, and that he of course acknowledged that there are many things we can't know, but that's simply a reason to inquire even further. And I think there shouldn't be any doubt that there is such a thing as truth. Once you let go of that, once you say that that's a completely relative thing, depending on status and privilege and race and so on and so forth, well, then you enter very dangerous ground, because, of course, that's also what, let's say, the Nazis claimed, that there was a Jewish science and then there was an Aryan science. And whereas Spinoza would have said, there's only one science. I mean, he was a universalist in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that is kind of striking, that you criticize the right-wing attacks on truth, but you're just as hard on progressives who you say believe that all truth is but a reflection of relative power. So again, we come back to this idea of something being objectively true and striving for it.
Yes, and that's exactly right. And I think, again, science is not the answer to everything, clearly. And there is room for spirituality, for things that cannot be scientifically necessarily explained. There should be room for people's emotions. But they should not be mixed up. You cannot say because somebody feels something to be true that therefore you have to acknowledge that it is true. Whereas scientific truth has to be reasoned and argued, and there has to be proof, and it can be disproven, and so on.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Spinoza's actual thought. I mean, you at one stage you point out that in some ways he's a bit like Karl Marx, that he's more quoted than he is actually read. What's the best place to start with Spinoza? And tell us a bit more about that central idea, his obsession, if you like, with freedom.
The Ethics is considered to be his masterpiece. It's also the hardest to read, but a lot of his philosophy is in the Ethics. The Theological Political Treatise is a very good place to start. It's easier to read. And in an abstract way, his politics, as well as his philosophy, come out of that very clearly. And he felt that the most important thing was not simply freedom of thought and expression in an abstract way, but in particularly the freedom for philosophers to think. He did not believe that everyone, in this sense, he would be dismissed as an elitist. He did not believe that everybody was educated enough and knowledgeable enough to be able to handle philosophical ideas. And in the wrong hands, people would get confused and angry and so on. He was very aware of the dangers of the mob.
Yeah, and he talks about the sensible people.
Yes, and in that sense, he was a little bit like the famous German-American scholar Leo Strauss, who believed that for the initiates, you could speak about certain things, but it shouldn't be shared too widely because then it could become dangerous. He did believe that, but the freedom of philosophy was the most important thing for him. But he also had that had political consequences. He thought that freedom to think would also create not only a freer society, but a better society where mistakes could be corrected, where no one had the monopoly on power and so on. And if one is interested in his politics, the least well-known of his books, which is the very last one, which he never finished because he died before the end, is the Political Treatise. And there he really goes through all the different forms of political organization of his time. And he talks about monarchies, he talks about aristocracies, and he ends up defending what he, democracy as he understood it. He couldn't have anticipated the liberal democracies that we still live in. But there he's very clear, unlike Hobbes. The great difference with Hobbes is that they both agreed that for society to be to work, people needed to feel safe, and needed to be safe from mob violence and impulses of the violent impulses of that human beings had. Now Hobbes thought that that was best safeguarded by having an absolute monarch. Spinoza did not believe that, but he did believe that there should be representative bodies of all the citizens, which could engage in politics and govern societies, and they should have the freedom of thought and expression.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned politics. His occasional forays into real-world politics were often baffling. Do you suggest that he was some kind of spy for the French King Louis XIV at one stage?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that wasn't so baffling, because even though the French had invaded the Dutch Republic, the more sophisticated French, including some of the officers, found a lot of common ground with the free thinkers in Holland. So I don't think that we don't know why he was invited by the French to come and meet them in a part of the country that was still occupied. Quite why he went is not entirely clear. But his actual politics, not the philosophy, but his actual politics, were not so baffling. The Dutch Republic at the time, and for a few decades, was governed by a patrician elite, people from big merchant families from Amsterdam and other parts of the west of Holland. And they were relatively liberal, and they were not democrats. They certainly saw themselves as an elite that was entitled to govern because they were superior to less educated and enlightened people. But they did leave room for the freedom philosophy that Spinoza thought was so important. And he did not believe in violent rebellion. He did not believe in violent revolution, which simply leads to more violence in his view. It's still better to obey a bad law than to use violence against the state. But one should be free to argue against bad laws and come up with something better. So he was a relatively moderate man, cautious even, who did believe in incremental change rather than revolutionary change. Even so, of course, his ideas were extremely radical and revolutionary for the time.
Yeah, and I mean, coming back to what we were talking about before, I wonder, you know, what do you make of writers like Patrick Deneen and others who've written about the Enlightenment in many ways giving birth to exactly the kind of problems that you were outlining before, and that Spinoza is part of that because of the way in which he talks about God and religion and so on. At one stage, you quote the Belgian poet saying that when men choose not to believe in God, they do not thereafter believe in nothing. They then become capable of believing in anything. So I wonder, you know, in many ways, Spinoza presented here as freedom's messiah, but is he part of the problem in where we've ended up in the way that someone like Deneen would argue?
This is, of course, very hot, very much contested. The great expert on King Spinoza, who's just written a book of more than 1,000 pages on him, Jonathan Israel, is firmly convinced that there is such a thing as a radical enlightenment, and he thinks Spinoza is really the father of that. And then you have the sort of the watered-down, wishy-washy enlightenment of Locke and others, and the Scottish Enlightenment, and which he dismisses rather. And as I said, Spinoza's ideas were indeed radical because they were so anti-clerical. And but he himself was not a radical. You're right in that he couldn't have anticipated the kind of totalitarian systems that we have seen in the 20th century, where religion was often abolished. And instead of that, you had cults around great leaders, and whether it's fascism or communism or anything else, he couldn't possibly foreseen that. He did not think that religion could be banned or should be banned or had no place. He had an idea that there could be such a thing as a kind of civic religion that promoted moral behavior and kindness and decency and so on. And he also believed that everybody should believe in any religion they wanted, but that organized religion should be controlled by the state so that the clerics couldn't exercise authority. He was firmly convinced of that. Now, the idea that the state would control organized religion, it has been argued, leads straight to the kind of totalitarian systems that we've seen in the 20th century. I think that's a bit unfair on Spinoza. It's an anachronism because he couldn't possibly have foreseen that. But of course, I mean, every great, certainly revolutionary chain has unforeseen consequences. And I mean, even in my own time, in the 1960s, I was a little bit too young to take part in the sort of, to be on the barricades. I was never a part of that. But in the 1960s, most educated liberal people agreed that toppling the authority of organized faith and churches and so on was a good thing. But of course, that did have unforeseen consequences. Yes, it was a good thing in that the priests gradually lost power, so there was less abuse and so on. But people are cast adrift. They have to believe in something. And, you know, if it's movie stars or rock stars or football players, that's relatively harmless. But if it's, you know, politicians and so on, it's no longer harmless. But these are things he couldn't possibly have foreseen. And so, you know, any great change can have consequences that in retrospect, one could say, regrettable.
The other thing that really struck me reading this book as well was the universalism of what Spinoza is saying. And, you know, again, that comes back to a lot of contemporary debates, essentially that, you know, whatever race, color, gender, creed a person may have, nevertheless, there's this kind of universal quality to human experience that strikes me as remarkable for the 17th century, but it strikes me as pretty remarkable for today too.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it's one of the most important things about him. I mean, it's one thing, of course, one other thing that really offended the Jews, because he totally negated the idea of the chosen people. He thought that was ridiculous. And human beings, in his view, all had the capacity for reason and reasoned thinking. And it didn't matter where you came from or what your culture was, people had that in common. So yes, that was extremely radical, but as you say, perhaps even more radical today.
Yeah, I mean, this book comes after your own brush with cancel culture when you were editor of the New York Review of Books. You know, I wonder, did that experience affect the writing of this book in any way and the attraction to this prophet, to this freedom's messiah?
Well, I've always been interested in the concept of freedom and what it means and the struggle for it and so on. So that's not new. I'm still a great admirer of Isaiah Berlin and his views on negative and positive freedom and so on. So I've always had that interest. It's certainly true that my own experiences perhaps have sharpened that interest. And I didn't write this book as a kind of riposte, but my interest in the question of freedom of speech and so on, yes, and it certainly had an effect of making me want to think about it even more.
Yeah, and as we said at the beginning, this book is in the Yale Jewish Live series. It comes out in the wake of those Hamas attacks on October 7th, but also the virulent anti-Semitism that it's released. I wonder, what do you make of the current situation, and what do you think Spinoza can teach us in this situation?
Well, I think, without seeming to butter anybody up, I think that the president of our own college, Leon Botstein, to whom I dedicated the book, has given rather a good example, and that when things became very heated between people who demonstrated for Palestine on the one hand and people who felt threatened by it on the other, that he made it very clear that everybody had the right to express the views that they wished, as long as they behaved in a civilized manner. And I think one reason, I mean, this is my impression, I don't spend as much time there as you do, but my impression is that things have not been quite as fraught on the campus at Bard College as they have at some Ivy League universities, and is largely due to that. And I think Spinoza would have approved.
No better place to end than that. So the book is Spinoza, Freedom's Messiah. It's written by my guest, Ian Baruma, and it's part of the Yale Jewish Live series. But for now, Ian, always a pleasure. Congratulations again, and thanks for joining us on Bookstack.
It was a pleasure.
So that's it from us this week. Don't forget to check our website, AmericanPurpose.com, and to leave us a review on your podcast app. The show is produced by Laura Silverman, and this is me, Richard Alder, saying thanks for listening.